Did you get the money? The old man asked him.
I borrowed some from Barak.
That's surprising. He is not notorious for his generosity.
I didn't tell him I was borrowing it, the little man returned with a broad wink. I thought it would save time if I didn't have to go into long explanations.
One of Belgareth's eyebrows shot up.
We are in a hurry, aren't we? Silk asked with an innocent expression. And Barak can be so tedious when it comes to money.
Spare me the excuses, Belgareth told him. He turned back toward Geryon. Have you finished with that yet?
What do you think? Geryon asked, handing him the note. The old man glanced at it.
Good enough. Now sign it. We'll put it where somebody will find it sometime tomorrow.
Late tomorrow, Silk suggested. I would like to be well out of Polgara's range when she finds out that we have left.
Geryon signed the note, folded it, and wrote, For Lady Polgara, across the outside.
We'll leave it on the throne, Belgareth said. Let's change clothes and go get the sword.
Isn't the sword going to be a bit bulky?
Silk asked after Geryon and Belgareth had changed.
There's a scabbard for it in one of the antechambers, Belgareth answered, opening the door carefully and peering out into the silent hall. He'll have to wear it slung across his back.
That glow is going to be a bit ostentatious, Silk said.
We will cover the orb. Let's go, Belgareth replied.
The three of them slipped out into the dimly lighted corridor and crept through the midnight stillness toward the throne room. Once, a sleepy servant going toward the kitchen almost surprised them, but an empty chamber provided them with a temporary hiding place until he had passed. Then they moved on.
Is it locked?
Silk whispered, when they reached the door to the Hall of the Riven King. Geryon took hold of the large handle and twisted, quincing as the latch clacked loudly in the midnight stillness. He pushed, and the door creaked as it swung open.
You ought to have somebody take care of that, Silk muttered.
The orb of Aldur began to glow faintly as soon as the three of them entered the hall.
It seems to recognize you, Silk observed to Geryon.
When Geryon took down the sword, the orb flared, filling the Hall of the Riven King with its deep blue radiance. Geryon looked around nervously, fearful that someone passing might see the light and come in to investigate.
Stop that,
he irrationally admonished the stone. With a startled flicker, the glow of the orb subsided back into a faint, pulsating light, and the triumphant song of the orb stilled to a murmur. Belgareth looked quizzically at his grandson, but said nothing. He led them to an antechamber and removed a long, plain scabbard from a case standing against the wall. The belt attached to the scabbard had seen a certain amount of use. The old man buckled it in place for Geryon, passing it over the young man's right shoulder and down across his chest, so that the scabbard, attached to the belt in two places, rode diagonally down his back. There was also a knitted tube in the case, almost like a narrow sock.
"Slide this over the hilt,"
Belgareth instructed. Geryon covered the hilt of his great sword with the tube and then took hold of the blade itself and carefully inserted the tip into the top of the scabbard. It was awkward, and neither Silk nor Belgareth offered to help him. All three of them knew why. The sword slid home, and since it seemed to have no weight, it was not too uncomfortable. The cross-piece of the hilt, however, stood out just at the top of his head, and tended to poke him if he moved too quickly.
"It wasn't really meant to be worn," Belgareth told him. "We had to improvise."
Once again, the three of them passed through the dimly lighted corridors of the sleeping palace and emerged through a side door. Silk slipped on ahead, moving as soundlessly as a cat and keeping to the shadows. Belgareth and Geryon waited. An open window, perhaps 20 feet overhead, faced out into the courtyard. As they stood together beneath it, a faint light appeared, and the voice that spoke down to them was very soft.
"Erend?"
it said.
Yes, Garion replied without thinking. Everything's all right. Go back to bed.
Belgarion,
the child said with a strange kind of satisfaction, and then he added,
Goodbye,
in a somewhat more wistful tone, and then he was gone.
Let's hope he doesn't run straight to Polgara, Belgarath muttered.
I think we can trust him, Grandfather. He knew we were leaving, and he just wanted to say goodbye.
Would you like to explain how you know that?
I don't know, Garion shrugged. I just do. Silk whistled from the courtyard gate, and Belgarath and Garion followed him down into the quiet streets of the city. It was still early spring, and the night was cool but not chilly. There was a fragrance in the air, washing down over the city from the high meadows and the mountains behind Reva, and mingling with the peat smoke and salty tang of the sea air. The stars overhead were bright, and the newly risen moon, looking swollen as it rode low over the horizon, cast a glittering golden path across the breast of the Sea of the Winds. Garion felt that excitement he always experienced when starting out at night. He had been cooped up too long, and each step that took him farther and farther from the dull round of appointments and ceremonies filled him with an almost intoxicating anticipation.
"'Tis good to be on the road again,' Belgarath murmured, as if reading his thoughts.
"'Is it always like this?' Garion whispered back. "'I mean, even after all of the years that you've been doing it?'
"'Always,' Belgarath replied. "'Why do you think I prefer the life of a vagabond?'
They moved on down through the dark streets to the city gate and out through a small sallyport to the wharves, jutting into the moon-dappled waters of the harbor. Captain Graldick was a bit drunk when they reached his ship. The vagrant seaman had ridden out the winter in the safety of the harbor at Riva. His ship had been hauled out on the strand, her bottom scraped and her seams recalked. Her mainmast, which had creaked rather alarmingly on the voyage from Sindaria, had been reinforced and fitted with new sails. Then Graldick and his crew had spent much of their time carousing. The effects of the 3 months of steady dissipation showed on his face when they woke him. His eyes were bleary, and there were dark stained pouches under them. His bearded face looked puffy and unwell.
"Maybe tomorrow," he grunted when Belgarath told him of their urgent need to leave the island. "Or the next day." "The next day would be better, I think."
Belgarath spoke more firmly.
"My sailors couldn't possibly man the oars," Graldick objected. "They'll be throwing up all over the deck. Takes a week to clean up a mess like that."
Belgarath delivered a blistering ultimatum then, and Graldick sullenly climbed out of his rumpled bunk. He lurched toward the crew's quarters, pausing only long enough to be noisily sick over the rail, and then he descended into the forward hold, where with kicks and curses he roused his men. The moon was high and dawn only a few hours off when Graldick's ship slid quietly out of the harbor and met the long rolling swells of the Sea of the Winds. When the sun came up, they were far out at sea. The weather held fair, even though the winds were not favorable, and in 2 days' time Graldick dropped Garion, Silk, and Belgarath off on a deserted beach just north of the mouth of the Saline River on the northwest coast of Sindaria.
"I don't know that I'd be in all that big a hurry to go back to Reva," Belgarath told Graldick as he stepped out of the small boat onto the sand of the beach.
He handed the bearded Kerik a small pouch of jingling coins.
"I'm sure you and your crew can find a bit of a diversion somewhere." "It's always nice in Kamar this time of year," Graldick mused, bouncing the pouch thoughtfully in his hand. "And I know a young widow there who's always been very friendly." "You ought to pay her a visit," Belgarath suggested. "You have been away for quite some time, and she's sure to have been terribly lonely for you."
"I think maybe I will," Graldick said, his eyes suddenly bright. "Have a good trip."
He motioned to his men, and they began rowing the small boat back toward the lean ship standing a few hundred yards offshore.
"What was that all about?" Geryon asked.
"I would like to get a bit of distance between us and Polgara before she gets her hands on Greldic," the old man replied. "I do not particularly want her chasing us."
He looked around.
"Let's see if we can find somebody with a boat to row us upriver to Selene. We should be able to buy horses and supplies there."
A fisherman, who immediately saw that turning ferry boatman would provide a more certain profit than trusting his luck on the banks of the northwest coast, agreed to take them upriver. By the time the sun was setting, they had arrived in the city of Selene. They spent the night in a comfortable inn, and went the following morning to the central market. Silk negotiated the purchase of horses, haggling down to the last penny, bargaining more out of habit, Geryon thought, than out of any real necessity. Then they bought supplies for the trip. By mid-morning, they were pounding along the road that led toward Darin some 40 leagues distant. The fields of northern Sindaria had begun to sprout that first green blush that lay on damp earth like a faint jade mist, and more than anything, announced spring. A few fleecy clouds scampered across the blue of the sky, and though the wind was gusty, the sun warmed the air. The road opened before them, stretching across the verdant fields, and though their mission was deadly serious, Geryon almost wanted to shout out of pure exuberance. In 2 more days, they reached Darin.
"Do you want to take ship here?"
Silk asked Belgarath, as they crested the hill up which they had come so many months before with their 3 wagon loads of turnips.
"We could be in Kotu inside of a week."
Belgarath scratched at his beard, looking out at the expanse of the Gulf of Kerch, glittering in the afternoon sun.
"I don't think so," he decided.
He pointed at several lean Kerch warboats patrolling just outside Sindarian territorial waters.
"The Kerchs are always moving around out there," Silk replied. "It might have nothing whatsoever to do with us."
"Polgara is very persistent," Belgarath said. "She cannot leave Reva herself as long as so many things are afoot there, but she can send people out to look for us. Let's avoid any possible trouble if we can. We'll go along the north coast, and then on up through the fens to Boktor."
Silk gave him a look of profound distaste.
"It will take us a lot longer," he objected.
"We are not in all of that great of a hurry," Belgarath remarked blandly. "The Alorns are beginning to mass their armies, but they still need more time, and it is going to take a while to get the Arryns all moving in the same direction."
"And what has that got to do with it?" Silk asked him.
"I have plans for those armies, and I'd like to start them moving before we cross into Garognadrak, if possible, and certainly before we get to Meloria. We can afford the time it will take to avoid any unpleasantness with the people Polgara sent out to find us."
And so they detoured around Darin and took the narrow, rocky road that led along the cliffs where the waves crashed and boomed and foamed, beating themselves to fragments against the great rocks of the north coast. The mountains of eastern Sindaria ran down into the Gulf of Kerch, along that forbidding shore, and the road which twisted and climbed and dropped steeply again. It was not a good road, Silk grumbled every mile of the way. Geryon, however, had other worries. The decision he had made after reading the Mren Codex had seemed quite logical at the time, but logic was scant comfort now. He was deliberately riding toward Meloria to face Torak in a duel. The more he thought about it, the more insane it seemed. How could he possibly hope to defeat a god? He brooded about that as they rode eastward along the rocky coast, and his mood became as unpleasant as Silk's. After about a week, the cliffs became lower, and the land more gently rolling. From the top of the last of the eastern foothills, they looked out and saw what appeared to be a vast, flat plain, dark green and very damp-looking.
Well, there they are,
Silk sourly informed Belgorath.
What has got you so bad-tempered?
The old man asked him.
One of the main reasons I left Drasny in the first place was to avoid the possibility of ever being obliged to go anywhere near the Fens,
Silk replied crisply.
And now you propose to drag me lengthwise through the whole soggy, stinking expanse of them. I am bitterly disappointed in you, old friend, and it's altogether possible that I will never forgive you for this.
Geryon was frowning at the marshland spread out below them.
That wouldn't be Drasnia, would it? I thought that Drasnia was farther north.
It is Algaria, actually, Belgorath told him. The beginning of Aldorfens. Up beyond the mouths of the Aldor River is the Drasnian border. They call it Bryn Marsh up there, but it's all the same swamp. It goes on for another 30 leagues or so beyond Kottu, at the mouth of the Mryn River.
Most people just call it the Fens, and let it go at that,
Silk observed.
Most people have sense enough to stay out of it,
he added pointedly.
Oh, quit complaining so much,
Belgorath told him bluntly.
There are fishermen along this coast. We'll buy a boat.
Silk's eyes brightened.
We can go up along the coast, then, he suggested.
That would not be very prudent,
Belgorath disagreed.
Not with Anhag's fleet scouring the Gulf of Sharak looking for us.
You do not know that they are looking for us,
Silk said quickly.
I know Polgra, Belgorath answered.
I feel that this trip is definitely growing sour on us,
Silk grumbled. The fishermen along the marshy coast were a peculiar mixture of Algars and Drasnians, close-mouthed and wary of strangers. Their villages were built on pilings driven deep into the marshy earth, and there lingered about them that peculiar odor of long-dead fish that hovers over fishing villages wherever one finds them. It took some time to find a man with a boat he was willing to sell, and even longer to persuade him that 3 horses and a few silver coins, beside, was a fair price for it.
It leaks,
Silk declared, pointing at the inch or so of water that had collected in the bottom of the boat as they poled away from the reeking village.
All boats leak, Silk,
Belgorath replied calmly.
It is the nature of boats to leak. Bail it out.
It will just fill up again.
Then you can bail it out again. Try not to let it get too far ahead of you.
The Fens stretched on interminably, a wilderness of cattails and rushes and dark, slow-moving water. There were channels and streams and, quite frequently, small lakes where the going was much easier. The air was humid, and in the evenings thick with gnats and mosquitoes. Frogs sang of love all night, greeting spring with intoxicated fervor. Little chirping frogs and great booming, bull-voiced frogs, as big as dinner plates. Fish leaped in the ponds and lakes, and beaver and muskrats nested on soggy islands. They poled their way through the confused maze of channels, marking the mouths of the Aldur, and continued northeasterly in the slowly warming northern spring. After a week or more, they crossed the indeterminate border and left Algaria behind. A false channel put them aground once, and they were obliged to climb out to heave and push their boat off a mud bank by main strength. When they were afloat again, Silk sat disconsolately on the gunwale, regarding his ruined boots that were dripping thick mud into the water. When he spoke, his voice was filled with profound disgust.
"Delightful," he said. "How wonderful to be home again, in dear old mucky Drasnia."
Chapter 18. Although it was all one vast swampland, it seemed to Geryon that the Fens here in Drasnia were subtly different from those farther south. The channels were narrower, for one thing, and they twisted and turned more frequently. After a couple of days of poling, he developed a growing conviction that they were lost.
"Are you sure you know where we're going?"
he demanded of Silk.
"I haven't the vaguest idea," Silk replied candidly.
"You keep saying that you know the way everywhere."
"There isn't any certain way here in the Fens, Geryon. All you can do is to keep going against the current and hope for the best."
"There's got to be a route. Why don't they put up markers or something?"
"It wouldn't do any good. Look."
The little man put his pole against a solid-looking hummock rising out of the water beside the boat and pushed. The hummock moved sluggishly away. Geryon stared at it in amazement.
"It is floating vegetation,"
Belgarath explained, stopping his poling to wipe the sweat from his face.
"Seeds fall on it, and it grows grass just like solid earth. Except that it's not solid. It floats wherever the wind and the current push it. That's why there aren't any permanent channels, and there is no definite route."
"It is not always just wind and current," Silk added darkly.
He glanced out at the lowering sun.
"We had better find something solid to tie up to for the night," he suggested.
"How about this one?"
Belgarath replied, pointing at a brushy hummock that was somewhat higher than those surrounding it. They poled their way to the clump of ground rising out of the surrounding water, and Silk kicked at it experimentally a few times.
"It seems to be stationary," he confirmed.
He stepped out of the boat and climbed to the top, frequently stamping his feet. The ground responded with a satisfactorily solid sound.
"There's a dry spot up here," he reported,
"and a pile of driftwood on the other side. We can sleep on solid ground for a change, and maybe even have a hot meal."
They pulled the boat far up onto the sloping side, and Silk took some rather exotic-seeming precautions to make certain that it was securely tied.
"Isn't that sort of unnecessary?" Geryon asked him.
"It isn't much of a boat," Silk replied. "But it is the only one we've got. Let's not take chances with it."
They got a fire going, and erected their single tent as the sun slowly settled in a cloud bank to the west, painting the marsh in a ruddy glow. Silk dug out a few pans and began to work on supper.
"It's too hot," Geryon advised critically, as the rat-faced little man prepared to lay strips of bacon in a smoking iron pan.
"Do you want to do this?"
"I was just warning you, that's all."
"I don't have your advantages, Geryon," Silk replied tartly. "I didn't grow up in Polgar's kitchen the way you did. I just make do the best I can."
"You don't have to be grumpy about it. I just thought you'd like to know that the pan's too hot."
"I think that I can manage without any more advice."
"Suit yourself, but you are going to burn the bacon."
Silk gave him an irritated look and started slapping bacon slices into the pan. The slices sizzled and smoked, and their edges turned black almost immediately.
"I told you so," Geryon murmured.
"Belgarath," Silk complained, "make him leave me alone."
"Come away, Geryon. He can burn supper without any help."
"Oh, thanks," Silk responded sarcastically.
Supper was not an absolute disaster. After they had eaten, they sat watching as the fire burned down and purple evening crept across the fens. The frogs took up their vast chorus among the reeds, and birds perched on the bending stalks of cattails, clucking and murmuring sleepily. There were faint splashes and rippling sounds in the brown water about them, and occasional eruptions of bubbles as swamp gas gurgled to the surface. Silk sighed bitterly.
"I hate this place. I absolutely hate it."
That night, Geryon had a nightmare.
It was not the first he had suffered since they had left Riva. And as he sat up, sweat-drenched and trembling, he was positive it would not be the last. It was not a new nightmare, but rather was one which had periodically haunted his sleep since boyhood. Unlike an ordinary bad dream, this one did not involve being chased or threatened, but consisted rather of a single image. The image of a hideously maimed face. Although he had never actually seen the owner of the face, he knew exactly whose face it was. And now he knew why it had inhabited his darkest dreams. The next day dawned cloudy with a threat of approaching rain. As Belgarath stirred up the fire and Silk rummaged through his pack for something suitable for breakfast, Geryon stood looking out at the swamp around them. A flight of geese swept by overhead in a ragged V, their wings whistling and their muted cries drifting lonely and remote. A fish jumped not far from the edge of the hummock, and Geryon watched the ripples widening out toward the far shore. He looked for quite some time at that shore before he realized exactly what it was he was seeing. Concerned, then a bit alarmed, he began to peer first this way and then that.
"Grandfather, look!"
"At what?"
"It's all changed. There aren't any channels anymore. We are in the middle of a big pond. There isn't any way out of it."
He spun around, desperately trying to see some exit, but the edges of the pond in which they sat were totally unbroken. There were no channels leading out of it, and the brown water was absolutely still, showing no evidence of current. Then, in the center of the pond, without making so much as a ripple, a round, furred head emerged from the water. The animal's eyes were very large and bright. It had no external ears, and its little nose was as black as a button. It made a peculiar chirping noise, and another head emerged out of the water a few feet away.
"Finlings," Silk gasped, drawing his short sword with a steely rustle.
"Oh, put that away," Belgarath told him disgustedly. "They aren't going to hurt you."
"They have trapped us, haven't they? What do they want?"
"Breakfast, obviously," Silk answered, still holding his sword.
"Don't be stupid, Silk. Why would they want to eat a raw Dresnian when there is a whole swamp full of fish available? Put the sword away."
The first finling, which had poked its head up out of the water, lifted one of its webbed forefeet and made a peremptory gesture. The webbed foot was strangely hand-like.
"They seem to want us to follow them," Belgarath said calmly.
"And you are going to do it?"
Silk was aghast.
"Are you mad?"
"Do we have any choice?"
Without further discussion, Belgarath began taking down the tent.
"Are they monsters, Grandfather?"
Geryon asked worriedly, as he helped.
"Like Algroths or trolls?"
"No. They are just animals, like seals or beaver. They are curious and intelligent and very playful."
"But they play very nasty games," Silk added.
After they had stowed all of their packs into the boat, they pushed it down the bank into the water. The finlings watched them curiously with no particular threat or malice in their gaze, but rather a kind of firm determination on their furry little faces. The solid-looking edge of the pond opened then to reveal the channel that had been concealed during the night. The strangely rounded head of the finling who had gestured to them moved on ahead, leading the way and glancing back often to be certain that they were still following. Several others trailed after the boat, their large eyes alert. It began to rain, a few drops at first, and then a steady drizzle that veiled the endless expanse of reed and cattail stretching out on all sides of them.
"Where do you think they are taking us?"
Silk asked, stopping his poling to wipe the rain out of his face.
One of the Finlings behind the boat chattered angrily at him until he dug his pole into the muddy bottom of the channel again.
"We'll just have to wait and see," Belgarath replied.
The channel continued to open before them, and they poled steadily along, following the round-headed Finling who had first appeared.
"Are those trees up ahead?"
Silk asked, peering into the misty drizzle.
"It appears so. I suspect that's where we are going."
The large cluster of trees slowly emerged from the mist. As they drew closer, Geryon could see a gentle rise of ground swelling up out of the reeds and water. The grove, which crowned the island, appeared to be mostly willows with long, trailing branches. The Finling, who had been leading them, swam on ahead. When it reached the island, it emerged half out of the water and gave a strange, whistling cry. A moment or so later, a hooded figure stepped out of the trees and moved slowly down to the bank. Geryon did not know what to expect. But he was more than a little startled when the brown-cloaked figure on the shore pushed back the hood to reveal a woman's face that, though very old, still bore the luminous traces of what had once been an extraordinary beauty.
"Hail, Belgarath,"
she greeted, in an oddly neutral voice.
"Hello, Vordai," he replied conversationally. "It has been quite a while, hasn't it?"
The little creatures that had guided them to the island waded out of the water to gather around the brown-cloaked woman. They chirped and chattered to her, and she looked at them fondly, touching their wet fur with gentle fingers. They were medium-sized animals with short hind legs and little rounded bellies, and they walked upright with a peculiar quick shuffle, their forepaws held delicately in front of their furry chests.
"Come inside, out of the rain, Belgarath," the woman said. "Bring your friends."
She turned and walked up a path leading into the willow grove with her Finlings scampering along beside her.
"What do we do?"
Geryon whispered.
"We go inside," Belgarath replied, stepping out of the boat onto the island.
Geryon was not sure what to expect as he and Silk followed the old man up the path toward the dripping willows. But he was totally unprepared for the neat thatch-roofed cottage with its small adjoining garden. The house was built of weathered logs, tightly chinked with moss, and a wispy tendril of smoke drifted from its chimney. At the doorway, the woman in brown carefully wiped her feet on a rush mat and shook the rain out of her cloak. Then she opened the door and went inside without looking back. Selk's expression was dubious as he stopped outside of the cottage.
"Are you sure this is a good idea, Belgarath? I have heard stories about Vordai."
"It is the only way to find out what she wants," Belgarath told him. "And I'm very sure we aren't going any farther until we talk with her. Let's go in. Be sure to wipe your feet."
The interior of Vordai's cottage was scrupulously neat. The ceilings were low and heavily beamed. The wooden floor was scrubbed to whiteness, and a table and chairs sat before an arched fireplace, where a pot hung in the flames from an iron arm. There were wildflowers in a vase on the table, and curtains at the window overlooking the garden.
"Why don't you introduce your friends to me, Belgarath?"
the woman suggested, hanging her cloak on a peg. She smoothed the front of her plain brown dress.
"As you wish, Vordai," the old man replied politely. "This is Prince Keldar, your countryman. And this is King Belgarion of Reva."
"Noble guests,"
the woman observed in that strangely neutral voice.
"Welcome to the House of Vordai."
"Forgive me, madam," Silk said in his most courtly manner, "but your reputation seems to be grossly inaccurate."
"Vordai, the Witch of the Finns?" she asked, looking amused. "Do they still call me that?"
He smiled in return.
Their descriptions are misleading, to say the least.
The Hag of the Swamps,
she mimicked the speech of a credulous peasant.
Drowner of travelers, and Queen of the Findlings.
There was a bitter twist to her lips.
That's more or less what they would say, he told her. I always believed you were a myth, conjured up to frighten unruly children.
But I will get you and gobble you up,
she laughed, but there was no humor in her laughter.
I have been hearing that for generations. Take off your cloaks, gentlemen. Sit down. Make yourselves comfortable. You will be staying for a while.
One of the Finlings, the one who had led them to the island, Geryon thought, chattered at her in a piping little voice, glancing nervously at the pot hanging in the fire.
Yes, she answered quite calmly. I know that it's boiling, Chupik. It has to boil or it won't cook.
She turned back to her guests.
Breakfast will be ready in a bit. Chupik tells me you have not eaten yet.
You can communicate with them? Silk sounded surprised.
Isn't that obvious, Prince Keldar? Here, let me hang your cloaks by the fire to dry.
She stopped and regarded Geryon gravely.
So great a sword for one so young,
she noted, looking at the great hilt rising above his shoulder.
Stand it in the corner, King Belgarion. There's no one to fight here.
Geryon inclined his head politely, unbuckled the sword belt, and handed her his cloak. Another somewhat smaller Finling darted out of a corner with a piece of cloth and began busily wiping up the water that had dripped from their cloaks, chattering disapprovingly all the while.
You'll have to forgive Poppy,
Vordai smiled.
She is obsessed with tidiness. I sometimes think that if I left her alone she would sweep holes in the floor.
They are changing, Vordai,
Bilgarath said gravely, seating himself at the table.
I know,
she replied, going to the fireplace to stir the bubbling pot.
I have watched them over the years. They are not the same as they were when I came here.
It was a mistake to tamper with them.
So you have said before. You and Polgara both. How is she, by the way?
Probably raging by now. We slipped out of the citadel at Revam without telling her we were leaving, and that sort of thing irritates her.
Polgara was born irritable.
We agree on that point, anyway.
Breakfast is ready.
She lifted the pot with a curved iron hook and set it on the table. Poppy scampered over to a cupboard standing against the far wall and brought back a stack of wooden bowls, then returned for spoons. Her large eyes were very bright, and she chittered seriously at the three visitors.
She's telling you not to drop crumbs on her clean floor,
Vordai advised them, removing a steaming loaf of bread from an oven built into the side of the fireplace.
Crumbs infuriate her.
We will be careful, Belgarath promised.
It was a peculiar sort of breakfast, Geryon thought. The stew that came steaming from the pot was thick, with strange vegetables floating in it, and large chunks of fish. It was delicately seasoned, however, and he found it delicious. By the time he had finished eating, he rather reluctantly concluded that Vordai might even be as good a cook as Aunt Paul.
Excellent, Vordai,
Belgarath complimented her, finally pushing his bowl away.
Now, suppose we get down to business. Why did you have us brought here?
To talk, Belgarath. I don't get much company, and conversation's a good way to pass a rainy morning. Why have you come into the Finns?
The prophecy moves on, Vordai. Even if sometimes we don't. The Raven King has returned, and Torek stirs in his sleep.
Ah,
she said, without much real interest. The Orb of Audor stands on the pommel of Belgarion's sword. The day is not far off when the Child of Light and the Child of Dark must meet. We go toward that meeting, and all mankind awaits the outcome.
Except me, Belgarath.
She gave him a penetrating look.
The fate of mankind is a matter of only the mildest curiosity to me. I was excluded from mankind 300 years ago, you'll remember.
Those people are all long dead, Vordai.
Their descendants are no different. Could I walk into any village in this part of Drasnia and tell the good villagers who I am, without being stoned or burned?
Villagers are the same the world over, madam, Silk put in. Provincial, stupid, and superstitious. Not all men are like that.
All men are the same, Prince Keldar,
she disagreed.
When I was young, I tried to involve myself in the affairs of my village. I only wanted to help. But very soon not a cow died or a baby took colic without my being blamed for it. They stoned me finally and tried to drag me back to the village to burn me at the stake. They had quite a celebration planned. I managed to escape. I took refuge in the Fens. After that, I had very little interest in the affairs of men.
You probably should not have displayed your talents quite so openly. People prefer not to believe in that sort of thing, Belgarath told her. There is a whole catalogue of nasty little emotions curdling in the human spirit. And anything the least bit out of the ordinary raises the possibility of retribution.
My village learned that it was more than a possibility,
she replied, with a certain grim satisfaction.
What happened?
Geryon asked curiously.
It started raining,
Vordai told him, with an odd smile.
Is that all?
It was enough. It rained on that village for 5 years, King Belgarion. Just on the village. 100 yards beyond the last house, everything was normal. But in the village, there was rain. They tried to move twice, but the rain followed them. Finally, they gave up and left the area. For all I know, some of their descendants are still wandering.
You're not serious, Silk scoffed.
Quite serious.
She gave him an amused look.
Your credulity appears selective, Prince Keldar. Here you are, going about the world in the company of Belgarath, the sorcerer. I am sure that you believe in his power, but you cannot bring yourself to accept the idea of the power of the Witch of the Fens.
Silk stared at her.
I really am a witch, Prince Keldar. I could demonstrate if you wish, but I don't think you'd like it very much. People seldom do.
That isn't really necessary, Vordai. What is it that you want exactly?
I was coming to that, Belgarath. After I escaped into the Fens, I discovered my little friends here.
She affectionately stroked the side of Poppy's furry little face, and Poppy nuzzled at her, ecstatically.
They were afraid of me at first, but they finally grew less shy. They began bringing me fish and flowers as tokens of friendship. And I needed friends very badly at that time. I altered them a bit out of gratitude.
You shouldn't have, you know, the old man said rather sadly.
She shrugged.
Should. Shouldn't. They have very little meaning to me anymore.
Not even the gods would do what you did.
The gods have other amusements.
She looked directly at him then.
I have been waiting for you, Belgarath, for years now. I know that sooner or later you would come back into the Fens. This meeting you spoke of is very important to you, isn't it?
It is the most important event in the history of the world.
That depends on your point of view, I suppose. You need my help, though.
I think we can manage, would I?
Perhaps. But how do you expect to get out of the Fens?
He looked at her sharply.
I can open the way for you to the dry ground at the edge of the swamp. Or I can see to it that you wander around in these marshes forever, in which case this meeting you are concerned about will never happen, will it? That puts me in a very interesting situation, wouldn't you say?
Belgarath's eyes narrowed.
I discovered that when men deal with each other, there is usually an exchange of some kind,
she added, with a strange little smile.
Something for something, nothing for nothing. It seems to be a sensible arrangement.
Exactly what did you have in mind?
The Finlings are my friends, in a very special way my children. But men look upon them as animals with pelts worth the taking. They trap them, Belgarath, and they kill them for their fur. The fine ladies in Bochtor and Kotu dress themselves in the skins of my children, giving no thought to the grief it causes me. They call my children animals, and they come into the Fens to hunt them.
They are animals, Vordai, he told her gently.
Not anymore.
Almost without seeming to think, Vordai put her arm about Poppy's shoulders.
It may be that you were right when you said that I should not have tampered with them. But it is too late now to change it back.
She sighed then.
I am a witch, Belgarath, not a sorceress. My life has a beginning and an end, and it is approaching its end, I think. I won't live forever, as you and Polgara have. I have lived several hundred years already, and I am growing very tired of life. As long as I am alive, I can keep men from coming into the Fens. But once I am gone, my children will have no protection.
And you want me to take them into my care?
No, Belgarath. You are too busy, and sometimes you forget promises you don't care to remember. I want you to do the one thing that will make it forever impossible for men to think of the Finlings as animals.
His eyes widened as what she was suggesting dawned on him.
I want you to give my children the power of speech, Belgarath,
Vordai said.
I cannot do it. My witchcraft does not reach that far. Only a sorcerer can make it possible for them to talk.
Vordai!
That is my price, Belgarath. That's what my help will cost you. Take it, or leave it.
Chapter 19. They slept that night in Vordai's cottage, though Geryon slept very little. The ultimatum of the Witch of the Fens troubled him profoundly. He knew that tampering with nature had far-reaching effects, and to go as far as Vordai wished might forever erase the dividing line between men and animals. The philosophical and theological implications of that step were staggering. There were, moreover, other worries. It was entirely possible that Belgarath could not do what Vordai demanded of him. Geryon was almost positive that his grandfather had not attempted to use his will since his collapse months before, and now, Vordai had set him an almost impossible task. What would happen to Belgarath if he tried and failed? What would that do to him? Would the doubts then take over and rob him of any possibility of ever regaining his power? Desperately, Geryon tried to think of a way to warn his grandfather without arousing those fatal doubts. But they absolutely had to get out of the Fens. However reluctantly Geryon had made the decision to meet Torak, he now knew that it was the only possible choice open to him. The meeting, however, could not be delayed indefinitely. If it were put off too long, events would move on, and the world would be plunged into the war they were all so desperately trying to head off. Vordai's threat to trap them all here in the Fens unless Belgarath paid her price threatened not only them, but the entire world. In a very real sense, she held the fate of all mankind in her uncaring hands. Try though he might, Geryon could not think of any way to avoid the test of Belgarath's will. Though he would reluctantly have done what Vordai wished himself, he did not even know where to begin. If it could be done at all, his grandfather was the only one who could do it. If his illness had not destroyed his power. When dawn crept through the misty fens, Belgarath arose and sat before the fire, brooding into the crackling flames with a somber face.
"Well?" Vordai asked him. "Have you decided?"
"It is wrong, Vordai. Nature cries out against it."
"I am much closer to nature than you are, Belgarath. Witches live more intimately with her than sorcerers do. I can feel the turning of the seasons in my blood, and the earth is alive under my feet. I hear no outcry. Nature loves all her creatures, and she would grieve over the obliteration of my fenlings almost as much as I. But that's really beside the point, isn't it? Even though the very rocks shrieked out against it, I would not relent."
Silk exchanged a quick look with Geryon, and the little man's sharp face seemed as troubled as Belgarath's.
"Are the fenlings really beasts?"
Vordai continued. She pointed to where Popi still slept, her delicate forepaws open like little hands. Tupik, moving stealthily, crept back into the house carrying a handful of dew-drenched swamp flowers. With precise care he placed them about the slumbering Popi, and gently laid the last one in her open palm. Then, with an oddly patient expression, he sat on his haunches to watch her awakening. Popi stirred, stretched, and yawned. She brought the flower to her little black nose and sniffed at it, looking affectionately at the expectant Tupik. She made a happy little chirping sound, and then she and Tupik scampered off together for a morning swim in the cool water of the swamp.
"It is a courting ritual,"
Vordai explained.
"Tupik wants Popi to be his mate, and as long as she continues to accept his gifts, he knows that she is still fond of him. It will go on for quite some time, and then they will swim off into the swamp together for a week or so. When they come back, they will be mates for life. Is that really so different from the way young humans behave?"
Her question profoundly disturbed Geryon for some reason that he could not quite put his finger on.
"Look there,"
Vordai told them, pointing through the window at a group of young fenlings, scarcely more than babies, at play. They had fashioned a ball out of moss and were rapidly passing it around in a circle, their large eyes intent on their game.
"Could not a human child join that group and not feel the slightest bit out of place?"
Not far beyond the game, a mature female fenling cradled her sleeping baby, rocking gently with her cheek against the little one's face.
Is not motherhood universal?
Fordai asked.
In what way do my children differ from humans? Except that they are perhaps more decent, more honest and loving with each other?
Belgarath sighed. All right, Fordai. You have made your point. I will grant that the Fenlings are probably nicer creatures than men. I don't know that speech will improve them. But if that's what you want, he shrugged.
You'll do it then?
I know it is wrong, but I will try to do what you ask. I really don't have much choice, do I?
No, you don't. Will you need anything? I have all of the customary implements and compounds.
He shook his head. Sorcery does not work that way. Witchcraft involves the summoning of spirits. But sorcery comes all from within. Someday, if we have the leisure, I'll explain the difference to you.
He stood up then.
I don't suppose you would care to change your mind about this.
Her face hardened.
No, Belgarath.
He sighed again.
All right, Fordai. I'll be back in a bit.
He turned quietly and walked out into the mist-shrouded morning. In the silence that followed his departure, Geryon closely watched Fordai for some hint that her determination might not be as iron-hard as it seemed. It had occurred to him that if she were not blindly adamant, he might be able to explain the situation and persuade her to relent. The Witch of the Fens paced nervously about the room, picking things up absently and setting them down again. She seemed unable to concentrate her attention on any one thing for more than a moment.
This may ruin him, you know,
Geryon told her quietly. Bluntness, perhaps, might sway her where other attempts at persuasion had failed.
What are you talking about?
He was very ill last winter. He and Kuvchik fought each other for possession of the orb,
Geryon replied.
Kuvchik was destroyed, but Belgarath nearly died too. It's quite possible that his power was destroyed by his illness.
Silk's gasp was clearly audible.
Why didn't you tell us? He exclaimed.
Aunt Paul said that we didn't dare. We couldn't take any chance of word of it getting back to the Angorax. Belgarath's power is the one thing that has held them in check all of these years. If he has lost it, and they find out, they will feel free to invade the West.
Does he know?
Fordai asked quickly.
I don't think so. Neither one of us said anything to him about it. We couldn't let him think for a moment that anything might be wrong. If he has one single doubt, it won't work for him. That's the main thing about sorcery. You have to believe that what you want to happen is going to, otherwise nothing happens at all. And each time you fail, it gets worse.
What did you mean when you said that this might ruin him?
Vordai's face looked stricken, and Geryon began to have some hope.
He may still have his power, or some of it, but not enough to do what you have asked of him. Takes a tremendous effort to do even simple things, and what you have asked him to do is very difficult. It could be too much for him. But once he starts, he won't be able to stop. And the effort may drain his will and his life energy until he cannot ever recover, or until he dies.
Why didn't you tell me?
Fordai demanded, her face anguished.
I couldn't. Not without his hearing me, too.
She turned quickly toward the door.
Belgarath!
She cried.
Wait!
She spun back to Geryon.
Go after him. Stop him.
That was what Geryon had been waiting for. He jumped to his feet and ran to the door. As he swung it open and was about to call out across the rainy yard, he felt a strange oppression as if something were almost happening. Almost, but not quite. The shout froze on his lips.
Go on, Geryon, Silk urged him.
I can't,
Geryon groaned.
He's already begun to pull in his will. He wouldn't even hear me.
Can you help him?
I don't even know exactly what he's trying to do, Silk,
Geryon replied helplessly.
If I went blundering in there now, all I would do is make things worse.
They stared at him in consternation. Geryon felt a strange, echoing surge. It was not at all what he had expected, and so he was totally unprepared for it. His grandfather was not trying to move anything or change anything, but instead he was calling out, reaching across some vast distance with the voice of his mind. The words were not at all distinct, but the one word, Master, did come through quite distinctly. Belgarath was trying to reach Aldur. Geryon held his breath. Then, from infinitely far away, Aldur's voice replied. They spoke together quietly for several moments, and all the while Geryon could feel the force of Belgarath's will, infused and magnified by the will of Aldur, growing stronger and stronger. What is happening? Silk's voice was almost frightened.
He's talking with Aldur. I can't hear what they're saying.
Will Aldur help him?
Vordai asked.
I don't know. I don't know if Aldur can use his will here. Not anymore. There's some kind of limitation. Something that he and the other gods agreed to.
Then the strange conversation ended, and Geryon felt Belgarath's will mounting, gathering itself.
He's begun,
Geryon said in a half-whisper.
His power is still there?
Silk asked. Geryon nodded.
As strong as ever? I don't know. There's no way to measure it.
The tension of it grew until it was almost intolerable. What Belgarath was doing was at once very subtle and very profound. There was no rushing surge or hollow echo this time. Instead, Geryon felt an odd tingling whisper as the old man's will was unleashed with agonizing slowness. The whisper seemed to be saying something over and over, something Geryon could almost understand, but which tantalizingly eluded him. Outside, the young fenlings stopped their game. The ball dropped unnoticed as the players all stood, listening intently. Poppy and Tupik, returning hand in hand from their swim, froze in their tracks and stood with their heads cocked as Belgarath's whisper spoke gently to them, reaching down into their thoughts, murmuring, explaining, teaching. Then their eyes widened, as if in sudden understanding. Belgarath emerged, finally, from the misty willows, his step heavy, weary. He walked slowly toward the house, stopping just outside to look intently at the stunned faces of the fenlings gathered in the dooryard. He nodded, then, and came back inside. His shoulders were slumped with exhaustion, and his white-bearded face seemed drained.
"Are you all right?"
Vordai asked him, her tone no longer neutral. He nodded and sank into a chair by the table.
"It's done," he said shortly.
Vordai looked at him, and her eyes narrowed suspiciously.
"No tricks, Vordai. And I'm too tired to try to lie to you. I have paid your price. If it is all right with you, we will leave right after breakfast. We still have a long way to go."
"I will need more than just your word, Belgarath. I don't really trust you, or any human for that matter. I want proof that you have paid."
But there was a strange new voice from the doorway. Poppy, her furry little face contorted with the effort, was struggling with something. She stammered. Her mouth twisted and she tried it again. It seemed to be the hardest thing that she had ever tried to do. She took a deep breath and tried once more.
Mother?
Poppy said. With a low cry, Vordai rushed to the little creature,
knelt and embraced her.
Mother,
Poppy said again, clearer this time. From outside the cottage there came a growing babble of small, squeaky voices, all repeating,
Mother! Mother! Mother!
The excited fenlings converged on the cottage, their voices swelling as more and more of them emerged from the swamps. Vordai wept.
You will have to teach them, of course, Belgareth said wearily. I gave them the ability, but they don't know very many words yet.
Vordai looked at him with tears streaming down her face.
Thank you, Belgareth,
she said in a faltering voice. The old man shrugged.
Something for something, he replied. Wasn't that the bargain?
It was Tupik who led them from the fens. The little creatures chirping to his fellows, however, now had words mixed in with it, faltering, often badly mispronounced, but words nonetheless. Geryon thought for a long time before he spoke, wrestling with an idea as he pushed on his pole.
Grandfather,
he said finally.
Yes, Geryon,
the old man replied from where he rested in the stern of their boat.
You knew all along, didn't you?
Knew what?
That it was possible that you could not make things happen anymore.
Belgareth stared at him.
Where did you get that idea?
And Paul said that after you got sick last winter, you might have lost all your power.
She said what?
She said that...
I heard you.
The old man was frowning, his face creased with thought.
That possibility never even occurred to me, he admitted. Suddenly he blinked and his eyes opened very wide. You know, she might have been right. The illness could have had that sort of effect. What an amazing thing.
You didn't... feel any, well, weaker?
What? No, of course not.
Belgareth was still frowning, turning the idea over in his mind.
What an amazing thing, he repeated,
and then he suddenly laughed.
Well, I don't see what's so funny.
Is that what's been bothering you and your aunt for all of these months? The two of you have been tiptoeing around me as if I were made out of thin glass.
We were afraid the Angorax might find out, and we didn't dare say anything to you because...
Because you were afraid it might make me doubt my abilities?
Geryon nodded.
Maybe in the long run. It wasn't a bad idea at that. I certainly didn't need any doubts plaguing me this morning.
Was it terribly difficult?
Moderately so, yes. I would not want to have to try that sort of thing every day.
But you didn't really have to do it, did you?
Do what?
Show the fenlings how to talk. If you still got your power, then between the two of us, you and I could have opened a channel straight through to the edge of the swamp, no matter what Vordai or the fenlings could have done to try to stop us.
I wondered how long it was going to be before that occurred to you, the old man replied blandly.
Geryon gave him an irritated look.
All right. Why did you do it, then, since you didn't have to?
That question is rather impolite, Geryon, Belgareth chided. There are certain courtesies customarily observed. It's not considered good manners to ask another sorcerer why he did something.
Geryon gave his grandfather an even harder look.
You are evading the question. Let's agree, then, that I don't have very good manners. And then you can go right ahead and answer anyway.
Belgareth appeared slightly injured.
It's not my fault that you and your aunt were so worried. You don't really have any reason to be so cross with me.
He paused, then looked at Geryon.
You're absolutely going to insist?
Yes, I think I really am. Why did you do it?
Belgareth sighed.
Vordai has been alone for most of her life, you know, and life has been very hard to her. Somehow I have always thought that she deserved better.
maybe this makes up for it a little bit.
Did Alder agree with you? I heard his voice when the two of you were talking.
Eavesdropping is really a bad habit, Geryon.
Oh, I've got lots of bad habits, Grandfather.
I don't know why you're taking this tone with me, boy, the old man complained. All right, since you're going to be this way about it. I did, as a matter of fact, have to talk rather fast to get my master to agree.
You did all of this because you felt sorry for her?
Well, that's not exactly the right term, Geryon. Let's just say that I have certain feelings about justice.
If you knew you were going to do it anyway, why did you argue with her?
Belgareth shrugged. I wanted to be sure that she really wanted it. Besides, it is not a good idea to let people get the idea that you will do anything they ask just because you might feel that they have a certain claim on you.
Silk was staring at the old man in amazement.
Compassion, Belgareth? He demanded incredulously.
From you? If word of this ever gets out, your reputation's going to be ruined.
Belgareth looked suddenly painfully embarrassed.
I don't know that we need to spread it around all that much, Silk. People don't really have to know about this, do they?
Geryon felt as if a door had suddenly opened. Silk, he realized, was right. He had never precisely thought of it that way, but Belgareth did have a certain reputation for ruthlessness. Most men felt that there was a kind of implacableness about the Eternal Man, a willingness to sacrifice anything in his single-minded drive toward a goal so obscure that no one else could ever fully understand it. But with this single act of compassion, he had revealed another, softer side of his nature. Belgareth, the sorcerer, was capable of human emotion and feelings, after all. The thought of how those feelings had been wounded by all of the horrors and pain he had seen and endured in 7,000 years came rushing in on Geryon, and he found himself staring at his grandfather with a profound new respect. The edge of the fens was marked by a solid-looking dike that stretched off into the misty distance in either direction.
The causeway, Silk told Geryon, pointing at the dike. It is part of the Tolnedran highway system.
Belgareth?
Tupik said, his head popping up out of the water beside the boat.
Thank you.
Oh, I rather think you'd have learned to talk eventually anyway, Tupik. You were very close to it, you know.
Maybe. Maybe not. Want to talk? Talk different? Not same?
Soon you learn to lie. Silk told him sardonically. And then you'll be as good as any man alive.
Why don't you talk if only to lie?
Tupik asked, puzzled.
It'll come to you, in time.
Tupik frowned slightly, and then his head slipped under the water. He came up one more time, some distance away from the boat.
Goodbye,
he called to them.
Tupik thanks you for mother.
Then, without a ripple, he disappeared.
What a strange little creature, Belgareth smiled.
With a startled exclamation, Silk frantically dug into his pocket. Something a pale green color leaped from his hand to plop into the water.
What's the matter?
Geryon asked him.
Silk shuddered. The little monster put a frog in my pocket. And perhaps it was meant as a gift, Belgareth suggested.
A frog.
Then again, perhaps it wasn't.
Belgareth grinned.
It's a little primitive, perhaps. But it might just be the beginnings of a sense of humor.
There was a Tolnedran hostel a few miles up the great causeway that ran north and south through the eastern edge of the fens. They reached it in the late afternoon and purchased horses at a price that made Silk wince. The following morning, they moved out at a canter in the direction of Bokdor. The strange interlude in the fens had given Geryon a great deal to think about. He began to perceive that compassion was a kind of love, broader
more encompassing than the somewhat narrow idea he had previously had of the emotion. The word love seemed, as he thought more deeply about it, to include a great number of things that at first glance did not seem to have anything whatsoever to do with it. As his understanding of this grew, a peculiar notion took hold of his imagination. His grandfather, the man they called Eternal, had probably in his 7,000 years developed a capacity for love beyond the ability of other men even remotely to guess. In spite of that gruff, irritable exterior, Belgorath's entire life had been an expression of that transcendent love. As they rode, Geryon glanced often at that strange old man, and the image of the remote, all-powerful sorcerer towering above the rest of humanity gradually faded. He began to see the real man behind the image, a complicated man, to be sure, but a very human one. 2 days later, in clearing weather, they reached Bokdor. Chapter 20. There was an open quality about Bokdor that Geryon noticed immediately as they rode through its broad streets. The houses were not, for the most part, over 2 stories high, and they were not jammed up against each other as they were in other cities. The avenues were wide and straight, and there was a minimum of litter in them. He commented on that as they rode along a spacious tree-lined boulevard. Bokdor is a new city, Silk explained, at least relatively.
I thought that it's been here since the time of Dras Bolnek.
Oh, it has, Silk replied. But the old city was destroyed by the Angoraks when they invaded 500 years ago.
I had forgotten that, Geryon admitted.
After Volmimbre, when the time came to rebuild, it was decided to take advantage of the chance to start over, Silk continued. He looked about rather distastefully. I don't really like Bokdor. There aren't enough alleys and back streets. It's almost impossible to move around without being seen. He turned to Belgorath. That reminds me of something, by the way. It probably wouldn't be a bad idea to avoid the central marketplace. I am rather well known here, and there is no point in letting the whole city know that we have arrived.
Do you think we'll be able to slip through unnoticed?
Geryon asked him.
In Bokdor?
Silk laughed. Of course not. We have already been identified a half dozen times. Spying is a major industry here. Boran knew we were coming before we'd even entered the city. He glanced up at a second-floor window, and his fingers flickered a quick rebuke in the gestures of the Drasnian secret language. The curtain at the window gave a guilty little twitch. Just too clumsy, he observed with profound disapproval. Must be a first-year student at the academy.
Probably nervous about seeing a celebrity, Belgorath suggested. You are, after all, something of a legend, Silk.
Well, there's still no excuse for sloppy work, Silk said. If I had time, I would stop by the academy and have a talk with the headmaster about it. He sighed then. Ah, the quality of student work has definitely gone downhill since they discontinued the use of the whipping post.
The what?
Geryon exclaimed. In my day, a student who was seen by the person he was assigned to watch was flogged, Silk told him. Flogging's a very effective teaching technique, Geryon.